This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Human rights has been a hot topic this election season, but what about non-human rights? Well, this week, while we've been dealing with the aftermath of a bitterly fought election, animal advocates have secured an important victory for primates. An Argentinian court has declared that a chimpanzee named Cecilia has the right to be free. Joining me to discuss this and other short subjects in Science, Election Week Edition, is my guest, Brandon Keim, freelance journalist and blogger for Anthropocene Magazine. Brandon, welcome back to Science Friday.
Great to see you again, Ira.
So given all the stuff going on this week, I'm not surprised this victory went under the radar, right? Give me a little thumbnail of what happened.
Well, reportedly, and I say reportedly because I haven't seen the legal documents and the stories I see and have been translated from the Spanish, and it's possible that some of the legal nuance got lost in the wash. But what we believe happened is that the judge said that Cecilia has a right to be free, or at least not to be kept in a zoo. And if this is the case, it's truly a landmark decision. The legal argument is actually one that's been pioneered by a group called the Non-Human Rights Project, and they have filed suit on behalf of three chimpanzee plaintiffs here in the United States, in the state of New York. And what they argue is that there is overwhelming scientific knowledge of chimpanzees as deeply intelligent and emotional and self-aware, able to remember the past and think of the future, and that, you know, all of these cognitive capacities are what underlie what we in humans value as our autonomy, our free will. And that raises the really interesting ethical and legal question of where do rights come from?
Yeah.
Are they rooted in what's in our minds and in our hearts, or do they just come with a species tag?
Mm-hmm. And what was the counter argument made by the judge up until this recent case?
So here in the U.S., the argument that's been made is that rights come from the ability of someone to fulfill their duties in society, that a chimp can't fulfill duties in a human society, and therefore they can't have rights. And then the rebuttal to that is that, well, you know, we very young children or elderly people with dementia, we don't expect them to recite the Constitution on demand, but certainly we do give them rights.
Mm-hmm. So is if this is true and you've read the reports correctly, does it have wider implications for other animals, other zoos?
I think it very well could, if not in as a narrow legal precedent outside of Argentina, certainly as a statement of what is possible and what a reasonable person can think.
Mm. Let's move on to the relatively good news in the area of climate change. Scientists have figured out that some birds are actually adapting to it. How do they know that?
So this comes from research that was conducted by Molly McGraw and Lucas de Groot at the Carnegie Museum of Natural History. And what they had was this extraordinary data set of 53 years of bird counts of 21 species. And so we're talking perching birds here, chickadees and thrushes and goldfinches and what have you. And what they did is they cross-referenced this with weather. And what many scientists have worried is that as springs come earlier and they're warmer and maybe more variable, that the birds' breeding cycles would get out of sync with this. They wouldn't lay eggs at the right time when there was food on the landscape. But so far, at least from this data set in western Pennsylvania, what we see is that birds are having families when the weather is good, and they have been able to adapt so far.
Mm-hmm. And for these birds, they did seem to able to track the changes in the weather. And when you say they were able to adapt, how do birds adapt? Do they?
Well, it's, you know, I think sometimes we think that birds' decisions are just purely instinctive and there's no thought. But actually, if you're a bird, maybe you wait until there's bugs hatching in the trees before you decide to have your family. This is a rational decision that you make. And I'm speculating here. The scientists didn't look at that question.
Yeah,
but,
I guess
but that's what one would say.
Or you could see when they're laying their eggs or stuff like that, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, if summer is long enough, maybe you have a second brood of eggs.
Exactly. And this does come with caveats. We're talking these 21 species, not all birds, and this is in one place. But I think of it as a very hopeful note, and we can think of it as Mother Nature's resilience giving us a chance to do everything else we could be doing to help birds.
And we've seen other animals. There's talk of coral. You know, the water is gets too warm for regular coral that we know, but maybe some other warm water, hardy coral are beginning to adapt to that.
Mother Nature's clever.
Is there any evidence to suggest that they will keep on adapting? Is there a limit? There's got to be a limit somewhere.
There probably is. And I think, you know, this is not an excuse to say we don't need to worry about climate change, but rather that, you know, we haven't hit that limit yet, and let's make sure we don't.
And finally, there's no evidence for this yet, but there's a theory out there that sperm whales make decisions democratically.
Yes, as we...
Do they vote? What do you mean? What does that mean?
Well, that's what blows my mind here. So the background to this, it comes from a scientist named Hal Whitehead, who's really been a pioneer in investigating a sperm whale names and culture and all these things. And he had this, he tracked the movements of two sperm whale clans in the Galapagos. And what he saw is that when they moved as a group, they weren't moving all at once, let's say like a flock of starlings, but they were actually moving in this sort of herky-jerky, messy way. And this turns out to be a movement signature of groups that make decisions democratically. And so that blew my mind when I heard it, because, how do they count the ballots, right? But democracy at its root, it's simple. It's just everybody's voice is heard and you make decisions collectively. This is just a hypothesis right now or a theory with some good evidence, but he's not sure of it. But the movement patterns suggest it. And it turns out actually that, you know, there's a number of species where democratic decision making takes place, and it's a good evolutionary strategy if everybody has something to contribute. And in the case of sperm whales, you're talking about dozens of individuals spread out across miles. And maybe one of them says, there's an upwelling of warm, nutrient-full water over here. And another says, hey, you know, I heard squid. We should go get the squid. And someone else says, well, you know, the last time you heard squid, you know, they tasted bad. And so they can work out amongst themselves where they want to go.
And they all take a vote because we all know they communicate with each other, right?
They do. And, you know, democracy, you don't need ballots. You just need to listen to what everyone says. And, you know, a really interesting wrinkle on this is, so we know that sperm whale culture can vary from clan to clan, and it's really fun to think of maybe their democratic practices vary from clan to clan, too.
Wow, we'll have to find out. Thank you. That's quite interesting and very pertinent this week, Brandon.
Yes, let's hope they have good conflict resolution mechanisms that we can learn from.
Absolutely. Brandon Keim is a freelance journalist and blogger for Anthropocene magazine. And now it's time to play Good Thing, Bad Thing. Because every story has a flip side. That sound you're listening to? It's a fish getting fried up by Chef Victor at Norman's Key, a Caribbean-style restaurant in downtown Manhattan. But this isn't red snapper or sea bass. It's a lionfish. No, the kind you see in your aquarium sometimes. It's black and orange with those spiky venomous fins that cover it, like a mane. Not your typical menu fare, I'm sure. I would say you're more apt to see it in an aquarium in somebody's apartment. So how did this deadly fish end up on a dinner plate? For that, we turn to my next guest, Maya McGuire, Florida Sea Grant Extension Agent with the University of Florida. Maya, welcome to Science Friday.
It's great to be here, Ira.
So how can you find lionfish on the menu at select restaurants now? But there are many, many more of them, right? Along the southern coast, southeastern coast of the U.S., they're sort of taking over in some places.
Sadly, that's true. They're found throughout the greater Caribbean area, in the Gulf of Mexico, and all the way up the east coast of the United States.
So are they competing with other fish? Is that what makes them a danger for being there?
Yes. The big problem is they are carnivorous fish, and so they eat smaller fish and some crustaceans, things like little shrimp. And the problem is they're eating the same food that our native fish would like to be eating, and they're also eating the juveniles of our native predatory fish.
So who finally said, let's get people to eat them? How did that start?
Yeah, I'm not sure who the individual was that first came up with that idea. I suspect it was several people, probably simultaneously, as these fish started to become pretty abundant and everybody started wondering, what can we do about them? You know, the first question often is, can we eat them? And so folks tried them, and they found that they're actually a very tasty fish. It's a mild white fish, and They take seasoning well. Chefs like working with them. So it kind of seemed like the perfect solution.
So how do you go about collecting them? Because they're not a schooling fish, right? You just can't put a net out and grab a whole bunch of them.
Right. They are a challenge to catch. They like to be on reef areas or areas with structure, and they actually like being under ledges a lot of the time. So it's not a great place to drag a net. They don't really take a hook very well. So the primary method by which they're caught is using divers, either armed with spear guns or with nets. So it's a pretty labor-intensive fishery.
So that's the bad thing about this. The good thing is that you can catch them and fry them up, and they taste good. The bad thing is that they're hard to go out and catch.
That's true.
Yeah. So it sounds like this isn't the ultimate solution to curbing this invasive species.
Not until we can come up with a better way to get rid of to catch the lionfish.
Right.
There are folks in many different places right now trying to design a trap that might be specific for lionfish in hopes that we can use that in deep water, shallow water, all over the place. But, of course, we don't want to be catching all of our native fish in those traps while we're trying to get the lionfish. So that's the challenge.
You know, sort of a good thing, bad thing in itself is that it's good that we're frying them up and eating them. But what if everybody likes them and wants more of them?
Well, at this point, the rate at which they've expanded throughout our area, we're not too concerned about running out of lionfish. They have a very high reproductive rate. A single female lionfish can release up to 2 million eggs in a year. So I think we'd have to work really, really, really hard before we had to worry about running out of lionfish.
Yeah, that's something we should all be worried about, yeah. All right. Thank you, Dr. McGuire. Maya McGuire is Florida Sea Grant Extension Agent with the University of Florida. Have a good weekend.
Thanks. You too.
We're going to take a break. And when we come back, it's how do we recover from the stress of this election? We'll have a psychologist tell us her thoughts on how we can overcome it. So stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. It's no exaggeration to say this has been the most polarizing, contentious, and bitterly fought election in recent memory. It's turned everyone watching into a tightly wound coil waiting to snap. Stressed. That's how people have described feeling recently. And even now that the election is over, that stress is probably lingering, either because you supported a different candidate or because you're reeling from such a hard-fought battle. You have, maybe it's political PTSD. So how do we recover from this? My next guest is a kind of stress expert who says the best way to find relief is to use stress as a weapon against itself. Change the stress that leaves you feeling powerless into stress that makes you powerful. Joining me to discuss exactly how to do this is Kelly McGonigal, a psychologist and researcher at the Stanford Center for Compassion and Altruism. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Now, there's something different about the stress people have been feeling as a result of this election. It feels more than just your average everyday stress. Am I right about that?
Yes, this is definitely different than everyday stress. What I've heard is that Americans across the political spectrum are reporting huge levels of social mistrust. They feel like the country has changed. They don't know who these people are anymore. They don't feel safe or respected or valued in their own community. And this is not the kind of stress that you can relieve with a bubble bath or a glass of wine.
If you're feeling stressful and you want to talk about it, as good psychologists always say, our number 844-724-8255. You can also tweet us at SciFry, 844-724-8255. Have there been studies done on the effects of this, what you're saying, this social mistrust?
Yes, yeah. One 2015 study actually asked adults in 87 different countries if they agreed with the statement that most people can be trusted. And they found that universally, social mistrust, it was linked to poor health and distress, whereas believing that people could be trusted was linked to well-being. And in fact, even some researchers who study genetics have found that social mistrust can change gene expression that alters the immune system. It can change your brain function in a way that increases your risk of everything we don't want, from depression to heart disease.
So that's what they say. And they say, we've heard that, if you stay stressed, you get sick.
And not just any kind of stress, though. It's the social mistrust is particularly toxic. It's very different than, say, the stress of ordinary hassles.
So the stress I'm experiencing as a result of this election can really be changing me at a cellular level.
In fact, some researchers call it a molecular memory for particularly stressful experiences.
So, let's get to the advice of how do I get rid of it?
Well, okay, so first of all, we're probably not going to get rid of the stress, and that's okay because we know that stress is a signal that something that we care about is at stake. And some kinds of stress responses can lead to positive action. It can inspire us to change, to grow, to connect with others. We want that kind of stress. What's really toxic about this election stress is the despair and the social disconnection that social mistrust leads to. It leads to a particular kind of stress response called a threat response that makes us want to escape, like, say, move to Canada, or to be really destructive, to burn things down, to heap more suffering on top of suffering. And I found that one way to change this kind of threat response into a more productive stress response is to actually believe that whoever you feel threatened by, whoever you view as the threat, to believe that they can change and the situation can change.
And so you have to change the threat response into some other kind of other response that you can channel better?
Yeah, so we know that you can have a challenge response, which is a stress response that actually gives you energy and courage. It creates the biology of courage so that you can act. You can have a tend and befriend stress response that makes you feel actually more empathy for others and a desire to come together to do something positive. And those are stress responses. Not all stress is bad. But again, in order to get to that kind of stress response, we need to transform this profound social mistrust, the sense that sort of others are the enemy and there's nothing we can do about it.
You know, it's a hard pill to swallow for a lot of people thinking that that they can change the way they believe. Is there evidence showing that that it will actually improve things if you change your beliefs?
This is a mindset that most people already have, and they just need to remind themselves of it. So, for example, one study at Stanford, they found that when you remind people that people can change, people in general can change, that they were then more likely to speak up against bias, against racism or sexism, and they were also more open to interacting with people who express that bias. They were more willing to collaborate, and they were less likely to want to avoid those people or to try to humiliate them. And there have been other experiments like this too, one that was conducted at the IDC in Israel that found that when you remind people that conflicts can change, that it increased hope and it increased people's willingness to actually collaborate and compromise to try to reach a more positive outcome with their political adversary. And again, this is a simple mindset reset. I mean, most of us, we want to believe that people can change, and this election is making us feel like maybe that's not true. And we need to double down on that positive hope so that we have the energy and the courage we need to move forward and stay engaged.
Let me see if I can get a phone call or two in here. Let's go to Rudy in Lamont, Illinois. Hi, welcome to Science Friday.
How you doing? Quick question. My father was an illegal immigrant, eventually became a citizen, and I was watching the news in Spanish yesterday. They had a new story about how politics is affecting young children. They're terrified that their parents are going to be deported. How can you help children who are living in real fear? I'll take my answer after I hang up.
Thank you. Yeah.
I mean, I have heard this too, where I live here in the San Francisco Bay Area. This is reality, and it's really important for us to have the courage to think about ways to make our children and make everyone in our community feel safe and valued and respected. And I think there are two things to think about. One is to try to be that safe place for children so that they know that they, in their own home or in their own schools, that they are valued and accepted and safe. And we can do that through love and kindness and trying to encourage them without dismissing the reality of current politics. But the other thing that I think people forget about is how important it is for kids to feel like they have something to do and to contribute. And whether that is writing a letter or joining in some sort of positive action in their own community, that it's really important for them not just to feel protected, but to feel like they have something to offer others. And this is true. This is not just for kids. This is for all of us. One of the biggest antidotes to moral distress and despair is moral elevation. And one way that we feel that is by ourselves doing something good in our own communities and witnessing that good in others. And I would say that in addition to simply trying to console and encourage people who feel scared, who may feel legitimately scared, that it's important to look for ways to uplift and not just to soothe.
Would that be sort of like volunteering, going out and doing something that you
Absolutely.
Know will help people?
Yeah, and it can be related to politics or not. I mean, basically, moral elevation is an antitoxin for all of this other stress that we're dealing with. And so if you don't know what to do about politics, do something good for a neighbor, do something good for a friend, do something good for a stranger. And because it changes our physiology, it's basically the opposite of a threat response. It's good for us, our immune systems, our cardiovascular systems. It creates hope and a sense of common humanity that when you do something like that, again, it puts you in that kind of a state and state of mind where the type of stress response you have in response to politics is more likely to be constructive and less likely to be that kind of overwhelming despair that that we really are trying to transform.
Mm-hmm. How about spending more time with your family or people who feel like you are stressed out the same way? Is that a good thing or a bad thing?
Yeah, I mean, one thing that really distinguishes this election stress from ordinary everyday stress is that it's bigger than self. And any tendency to, I think, retreat or to isolate yourself is going to make things worse. Mm. And so finding ways to be with communities that you care about, friends, family, other communities, it's really important. And it's really important to strengthen that sense that I'm not alone and also that sense that I have something to offer. And that's why, you know, you mentioned volunteering. That's one way to do it. But knowing what you have to offer your friends and family, that also is a powerful antidote.
Yeah, because a lot of people want to go nesting. They want to just hide, you know.
Yeah, and of course it makes sense. It's so important to have some compassion for yourself. There are a lot of people who are devastated right now. And eventually, you know, it's going to be important to come out of the cocoon and re-engage with the world.
All right. Thank you very much for taking time to be with us and some offering some good advice for us.
Thank you for having me.
Kelly McGonigal, a psychologist and researcher at the Stanford Center for Compassion and Altruism. Filmmaker Werner Herzog has spent decades crisscrossing the globe to tell the stories of humanity, from our origins to our possible end. His latest Into the Inferno film is no exception. It's a world tour of volcanoes, their power to devastate, and the stories and gods people have created in order to coexist with them.
It is hard to take your eyes off the fire that burns deep under our feet. Everywhere, under the crust of the continents and seabeds. It is a fire that wants to burst forth, and it could not care less about what we are doing up here.
The film takes us to Indonesia, Iceland, and even into isolated North Korea, while volcanic Mount Pektu has been woven into a nationalist mythology. Did you see the film yet? If you have, and if you want to talk about Werner Herzog's films in general, our number 844-724-8255, or you can tweet us at SciFry. Let me welcome Werner Herzog, director of Into the Inferno, which was released on Netflix last month. He joins us from L.A. Welcome back.
Yes, thank you for having me here.
Nice to have you. Tell me a little bit about the film. This isn't the first time you visited a volcano or volcanoes in your films. What is this fascination you have with them?
Well, it's a long history, right? I have woven things into it that have fascinated me since long time. Back in 1976, I mean, ages ago, I filmed a very volatile volcano in the Caribbean on the island of Guadeloupe, which was about to explode. And then 10 years ago, I filmed in Antarctica about people and scientists working there. Among others, there was an excursion up onto Mount Erebus, which is a right. very active volcano in Antarctica. And I met Clive Oppenheimer there, a volcanologist. And since then, we somehow plotted to do a film on volcanoes.
Let me bring him in. Dr. Clive Oppenheimer is a professor of volcanology at the University of Cambridge. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. Oppenheimer.
Thank you. Great to join the show.
What is the importance to you of understanding the people who live near the volcanoes you study, as we see so well documented in Werner's film?
On one level, it's important for us as scientists to understand what people and societies living on volcanoes think about the landscape and the terrain and the activity of a volcano. If we're going to communicate to them effectively when the volcano is showing signs of reactivation and we need to ask people to evacuate. We can't just waltz in them there and tell them that the seismometer's readings tell us it's you've got to leave now. We need to understand their belief systems and so on. But also some of the oral traditions tell us about past events that we didn't know about scientifically. So there's a lot to learn from the anthropology. And on top of that, they're just very, very compelling narratives and stories and cosmologies that people growing up on the side of volcanoes have about them.
Mm-hmm. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Talking with filmmaker Werner Herzog and volcanologist Clive Oppenheimer. Clive, what kind of film like this, as opposed to more straightforward science documentaries, how can this better communicate to viewers?
I think one thing it does, it goes beyond the doom and the gloom and the science to show that actually volcanoes, I think, connect with us. I mean, why are we all so mesmerized when we see footage of volcanoes? There's something quite atavistic about it. And I think part of that is our deep experience in terms of our human origins in the East African Rift Valley, growing up in the shadow of volcanoes and utilizing their resources but fleeing from eruptions from time to time. And so I think, you know, that volcanology is a discipline. It interfaces with so many other fields, whether it's the geoscience or the anthropology and archaeology or the literature, the humanities, the arts. It's a fascinating discipline because you can work at all of these interfaces where mm-hmm. the really interesting research is going on.
This film takes you and Werner to Ethiopia, where you help excavate fossilized hominids with paleoanthropologist Tim White. Connect that to volcanoes for us, if you can.
Well, it goes back to, you know, to our human origins and our archaic humans. I don't think it's a coincidence that this can be traced back to the East African Rift Valley, a very tectonically active and volcanically active part of the world. And the volcanoes gave us very valuable resources in terms of lava, stones that we use to make precision tools. But at the same time, we would have had to have fled our ancestors from eruptions from time to time. And I think, you know, the act of fleeing and then having to interact with unfamiliar groups, I mean, these experiences have built us up as a very resilient and adaptable species with the cognitive skills that we have today. So I really wanted for us to be able to root the film and the human experience of volcanoes in this very deep time perspective. And it was a huge thrill, I mean, working with Tim White and arriving when he just found this fabulous human fossil from 70,000 years ago was a huge thrill.
And we could see that. It's just amazing how you were all digging up those fossils there. And we know what a wild and crazy guy Tim White is from being on the show many times. What do you think, what's the connection, Clive, between you and Werner? Why do you think you sort of connected so well?
I think we fell in together as, not into the crater, but we fell in metaphorically in Antarctica. And I think it was, you know, in some ways serendipity. I was researching there and Werner was making a film and we met in a very remote field camp 10,000 feet up on an active volcano in Antarctica. So, you know, quite an unlikely set of circumstances. But I was very enchanted by Werner's storytelling around the dining table in our field hut in the evenings. And we shared our dreams about volcanoes. It turned out we both had a passion to visit the Tibesti volcanoes in northern Chad in the Sahara. And so I think, you know, we had a shared dream about making a film. I recognized La Soufriere is a wonderful film from 1976, but I could see Werner hadn't finished with volcanoes yet. So we stayed in touch.
Well, I know that you have a real job to get to, Clive. So I'm going to let you go and continue conversation with Werner Herzog. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you. Wonderful to be here.
Thanks for joining us.
Best to you, Clive. Yeah.
This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow.
Neath the sea, the land sinketh, the sun dimmeth. From the heavens fall the fair bright stars. Gushed forth steam and gutting fire. To very heaven soar the hurtling flames. The fates I fathom, yet farther I see. Of the mighty gods, the engulfing doom. Comes the darksome dragon flying, Neathhog, upwards from the Neatha fells.
He bears in his pinions, as the plains he overflies, naked corpses. Now he will sink.
Filmmaker Werner Herzog reading a passage from Iceland's Codex Regius, describing a volcanic apocalyptic event. We're talking with Herzog about his latest documentary, Into the Inferno. It is a stunning tour of volcanoes around the world and the ways that people interact with them. And Werner, it's always a theme of your movies to see how the people are affected by what you discover.
Well, it's a human side that was more interesting for me than the scientific side. However, we just had Clive Oppenheimer joining in via telephone. We have to face one thing. Of course, science is of enormous importance in volcanology and in crisis management. In 2010, when in Indonesia Mount Merapi exploded, his tool that he created, a spectrometer that measures gas emissions, was one of the key ingredients to start immediate evacuations of about 500,000 people very rapidly. And the mountain exploded. And it's very conservative that an estimate that I would say 20,000, maybe 50,000 lives were saved. So that's a very, very important site. However, we were looking more into the human side of it. What kind of demons do they create who live under the volcano? What kind of new gods do they create? And of course, we filmed in the Pacific archipelago of Vanuatu, and there's a strange cargo cult, John Frum, a mythical American GI, who would return with all the goodies of the consumer society, chewing gum, fridges, jukeboxes, maybe even a Cadillac. And they revere him as a god, and it's very, very strange. Or in North Korea, where for millennia the volcano Mount Paektu has been considered as the mythical birthplace of the Korean nation. It was appropriated 70 years ago by Kim Il-sung, the founding father of communist North Korea, and he declared it the epicenter of the dynamics of the Korean or North Korean revolution. So it's very strange how all of a sudden new gods, new demons, new relationships between man and mountain start to emerge.
You came back with some stunning photos, film from North Korea. How did you get access to those places?
Well, our program that we were permitted to shoot was basically the scientific research and collaboration between the University of Cambridge and North Korean scientists, the only such joint venture existing for them. But, excuse me, we somehow talked, or I talked them into allowing me to expand and to go into propaganda and presentation of the North Korean identity. We were allowed, not suddenly, but with a lot of talking, to film in a kindergarten, to film in the subway, to film in a stadium, things like that were not within our program.
Yeah, and there are some amazing footage that you got of erupting volcanoes, and one I noticed is that there you describe how there's lava rushing down the side of a mountain at you at 100 yeah. miles an hour, but you don't finish it up. We don't see what did you pick up the camera and leave, and why did you cut that part out? You
know? Well, I did not film that. That was back in the early 1990s, and it was an event that actually killed a French couple that has approached volcanoes so close that they were always in danger, and they created footage that nobody has ever seen before and after. And the event that actually killed them was a so-called pyroclastic flow. You have to imagine like a dust avalanche coming at you at 100 miles an hour and 850 degrees Fahrenheit heat inside. It kills you instantly. And this was filmed by a team of Japanese TV people who did one shot from a helicopter in the other shot, which was down there, and you see fleeing people and a fleeing fire truck, and it's coming at you, and they turned off the camera before actually this pyroclastic flow reached them.
Hmm. You know, if we look at your filmography, we can see that you follow other filmmakers whose subjects have led to their demise, like in your film Grizzly Man and White Diamond.
Right, yeah.
Do you relate to these people?
No, not necessarily. It's we shouldn't over-construct now the connections there. But I see your point, yes. Tragedy concerning the French couple, Katia and Maurice Kraft. But the beauty of their existence, and they always said, we do not want to die in our beds like 98% of all the other Frenchmen. I think Timothy Treadwell, who shot footage of unbelievable intensity and beauty, he didn't want to die in a bed either, I believe. And exposing himself to such dangers created footage, or he created footage that is unprecedented. We'll never see anything like that. And so the tragedy that befell him and his girlfriend, who was also killed and eaten by a bear, this tragedy as a side effect, a tragic side effect, has given us footage that we will never, ever see again.
Mm-hmm. Our number 844-724-8255 is our number. So lots of callers. Let's go to Chicago. Let's go to Dallas. Hi, welcome. Welcome. Chicago, you there?
Hello.
Hi there. Go ahead.
Hi. Hi, Ira. Hi, Werner. I just wanted to ask Werner, while making the film and studying the volcanoes for such a long period of time, did you learn anything about yourself as a person or a filmmaker?
Well, that's a question I try to avoid. Yes, you do learn, and you do learn to be prudent. And you see there's a strange public persona, an artificial public persona out there, as if I were the reckless daredevil who is just with wild obsessions facing the dangers. No, it's not like that. And Clive Oppenheimer 10 years ago was mostly surprised that I didn't rappel down into the crater itself, just getting close to the boiling magma. In a way, I have learned to be prudent. I want to come back with a movie. That's what I have learned, and I've always done that. You will not see me perish easily out of sheer stupidity.
That's good to know. All of your films this year, Into the Inferno, the Salt and Fire, Lo and Behold, they all feature scientists, whether fictional or real, and even physicist Lawrence Krauss plays a role in your eco-thriller. How would you describe your relationship to science, to scientists?
Yeah, we have to be careful. Salt and Fire is not an eco-thriller. It's more about a mysterious hostage-taking. But one of the villains in the film is Lawrence Krauss, who is a cosmologist. That's his day job. But when I met him some more than 10 years ago, I immediately had the feeling he should be a villain in one of my films. But he's also an expert talking about the internet. Very intelligent argument that he makes. And science, in a way, is a frontier that is so incredibly exciting. And much of what is happening there is very much cinematic, some sort of a quest and an excitement and something that you do not see anywhere else.
Yeah. Let me go to the phones. Our number, 844-724-8255. Let's go to Angela in Newark. Is it Newark, California?
Yes, Newark, California. Hi, Ira. Hi, Werner.
Hello.
Werner, can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
Yes, I do.
Hi. Hi. It's so thrilling to speak with you because I consider you to be an international living treasure. I wanted to thank you so much for all of your work, and particularly Into the Inferno. I have to say that Wednesday was a really difficult day for me and for much of the nation. And I have to say that I listened to you on Forum last week with Michael Krasny, or earlier this week with Michael Krasny. I think you were on Monday. And you'd made a comment about our election, and you'd assured Michael Krasny that we would all be okay, and that and I think you made a comment about having a beer on Wednesday nights to talk about things, and so of course my way of coping was to watch Into the Inferno on Wednesday night, and I want to say that it was very inspiring and humbling. And I was wondering if you maybe have a few inspiring and humbling words of wisdom for us today. I've just been, I've been thinking about since Tuesday what would Werner Herzog say right now to make.
Well, thank you very much for your kind words. And concerning the election, I think there was a surprise for many. But one thing that has bothered me for many, many years, and I've spoken out about it, East Coast and West Coast, always had a very cynical attitude about the American heartland. They speak of the flyovers, and the flyovers, the voices of all these people all of a sudden have risen, and they decided the outcome of the election. There's no doubt in my heart. And I think you should not really panic about things. The office itself is so important of the presidency of the United States. It will shape Donald Trump in a way. Don't doubt about it. And I do remember the days when Richard Nixon, Tricky Dick Nixon, was elected, and my friends were appalled. And I said, he is not a fluffy politician at all, not very likely, but he became an important president. There's no doubt in my heart, Ronald Reagan. All my friends were just appalled. A second-rate Hollywood actor now is trying to act as president. And I tried to point out, no, not so. He was a union leader for decades. He was governor of the state of California. And he became a great communicator. Whether you liked him or not doesn't matter. He was also an important president. And I think you should not panic. Tie your shoestrings well. Keep on walking and shape the future, which is far ahead of all of us and of you, the younger generation.
You're listening to Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Ira Flatow talking with Werner Herzog, author, filmmaker, director of Into the Inferno. So, Werner, how do you top this film? Have you got something else already in the works?
Well, I do have two feature films not released yet. One is Salt and Fire, which I shot in Bolivia, and one is Queen of the Desert with Nicole Kidman, some sort of a female Lawrence of Arabia. It should have been released more than a year ago, but there was a glitch between a production company and a distributor. I think it's sorted out. It will be released here in the States, yeah. A little late, though, but it's okay.
Are we done with the volcano themes in your films?
I shouldn't return to it. I mean, personally, yes, maybe I take some vacations and go to some wild raging volcanoes, but not for movie making. You don't do like Rocky 1, 2, 3, and 5. You don't volcano 1 till 16.
Well, how do you decide? You have such a unique way of shining a spotlight on things we've never thought we'd see on film. How do you decide what you're going to take up as a subject?
Well, very often things come at me with enormous vehemence and often uninvited. You wake up in the middle of the night and you hear something, and you get up and there are five burglars in the kitchen. And one comes swinging at you. I keep saying this is happening to me quite often. And I have to deal with it. So it's a kind of vehemence. In case of Into the Inferno, it was more a slower procedure, but I always knew there's something deeply moving and disturbing and cinematic about volcanoes. I have to do that with greater intensity.
Mm-hmm. And your footage is so dramatic, and you get up so, your photographers got so close to some of these volcanoes, it's almost miraculous that we didn't hear about more deaths of this film.
Well, as we are prudent, some of the footage was shot by drones. A helicopter cannot fly over a boiling cauldron of lava. It would explode from the heat. But we do have drones nowadays, and some of the beauty, really intense shots are done by drones. We had a very, very excellent drone operator, and it was great joy to film this. And also, of course, sometimes you take longer lenses, and you don't have to step that close to the boiling magma.
Well, we're glad you stuck close enough to get some great footage. It's a great film, Werner. Thank you for making it and showing it and sharing it with us. Werner Herzog, director most recently of Into the Inferno. It's streaming worldwide on Netflix. Check it out. Thanks for joining us again, and good luck in the future.
Thank you very much.
That's about all the time we have for this hour. Before we go, one more thing not to forget. This is a salute to men and women of the armed forces, living and dead. This is Veterans Day. We thank everybody for their service. Charles Berquist is our director, our senior producer, Christopher Intagliata. Our producers are Alex Salim, Annie Minoff, Christy Taylor, Katie Heiler. Luke Groskin is our video producer, Rich Kim, our technical director, Sarah Fishman and Jack Horowitz, our engineers at the controls here at the studios of our production partners, the City University of New York. Have a great holiday weekend. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.